Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hey, you. Yeah, talking to you. Welcome to Audible, where there's endless ways to ignite your imagination, like chase your thrills, slay your demons, even journey into the great unknown. And if you're lucky, discover someone, something new to love. Hear the latest audiobooks, podcasts, and originals at audible.ca.
Unmissable stories from around the globe from the BBC World Service.
My happy place, this is who I am.
Search for the documentary Lives Less Ordinary and Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday the 12th of February, these are our main stories. Two hostages in Gaza have been rescued by the Israeli military. Dozens of Palestinians were reported killed during the operation. Tributes have poured in for the holder of the men's marathon world record, Kenya's Kelvin Kiptum, who's been killed in a car accident. Also in this podcast, how a drop in international funding is having an impact on the Ukrainian front line. And
I didn't like hierarchy. Women entrepreneurs hate hierarchy. So no, I never thought it would be, ever thought it would be as big as it was.
The Body Shop, an ethically aware beauty brand with branches around the world, is calling in the administrators. We look at what went wrong. Up until today, the Israeli military had only been able to rescue one of the hostages taken to Gaza on October the 7th. But that tally has now risen to three. Israel announced on Monday that it had freed two men who were being held by Hamas fighters in a residential building in the city of Rafah. Idan Bejarano is a son-in-law of one of the men, Luis Ha. He described the moment when they were reunited.
We saw them, a lot of tears, hugs. Not many words, just being together, surrounded by the family and surrounded by our beloved people that were without us for so long, more than 4 months. We were so happy to see them. I don't know what is the real situation that they are, and we wish them good health.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the rescue operation showed military pressure was the only way to bring hostages back home. The Israeli military said overnight airstrikes on Rafah, the heaviest so far over the course of the past few days, provided cover for the rescue. The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says at least 67 people were killed in the strikes. A man whose relatives were among the dead, Ibrahim Hassouna, said they were a long distance from where the two hostages were being held and demanded to know why they'd been killed.
My family members were sleeping. We were displaced from Gaza. We rented a place and we were sitting safely. Why did you kill my family while they were sleeping? There are children. I've been collecting my family's body parts since the morning. They were in parts. I couldn't recognize them. I only recognized their toes or fingers.
Speaking from the city, which is crammed with more than a million displaced people, the head of the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Georgios Petropoulos, described the situation there.
In Rafah in particular, we are facing displacement of 1.3 to 1.5 million people, including the residents that were already here. Everyone is short of food, clean water, health services, sanitation, and even basic room. I mean, let's not forget, people are living, six families to one classroom at times. And you really see sort of a breakdown in what I would call the rule of law here in Rafah, as people are just terrified of what may come ahead.
Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Barbara Pletasha, told us more about these latest Israeli airstrikes on Rafah.
Well, they were part of a special joint operations force that was sent to rescue two hostages held in a residential building in Rafah, according to the Israeli army, and that included several different branches of the Israeli security forces, and it also included a heavy bombardment, according to the army, that was released in order to protect them as they departed. But it certainly put residents of the city in a panic because it's one of the most intense bombardments they've had, and they thought at the time that it might be the beginning of a ground offensive that Israel has been saying it was planning to do. That was not the case, but it did end up creating a fair bit of damage. At least two mosques and I think more than a dozen homes were hit. We've also had dozens of casualties reported. So it was quite a traumatic night for people in Rafah, although here in Israel, people are celebrating the rescue of two hostages.
And what do we know about these hostages?
They are older men, Fernando Marman in his 60s and Luis Har in his 70s. They are said to be in good medical condition, which is something that's a real relief for their families because they were held in captivity for 128 days. They're still in hospital at Tel Aviv, although they have been reunited with their families. And the son-in-law of Mr. Luis Har was speaking, talking about a very emotional reunion that had many more hugs and tears than words.
Now, Israel is saying that these overnight airstrikes provided cover for the rescue of these two hostages. But these airstrikes have been going on for some days now, and the death toll is mounting from them. What's the purpose of this ahead of this expected ground operation?
Those who have watched the Israeli military carry out its operations say that it usually starts with airstrikes, which is then followed by ground troops afterwards. But yes, it's something that is greatly concerning to the many people in Rafah at the moment. And if they have to be moved or evacuated, as the Prime Minister has said would happen for a ground offensive, it's not clear how that could be done effectively, something that Israel's international allies, including the United States, are pressing them to explain.
As you say, international allies pressing for an explanation, and President Biden also concerned about these airstrikes. Is there any sign that Israel is heeding these US warnings?
Well, the American administration had specifically used the phrase there should be no ground incursion into Rafah unless there is a proper plan for the security of civilians, after which Mr. Netanyahu came out and talked about an evacuation plan. I think that was at least one response to specific American rhetoric. But in general terms, the efforts by the Americans to get the Israelis to lower the tempo of their attacks, become more targeted in terms of anti-terrorism types of strikes rather than the kind of whole-scale bombardments that we've seen that have destroyed so much of Gaza and killed so many people, has been very slow going.
Barbara Plet-Usher in Jerusalem. Meanwhile, an appeals court in the Netherlands has ordered the Dutch government to halt the delivery of parts for F-35 fighter jets deployed by Israel in its bombardment of Gaza over concerns that they could be used to violate international humanitarian law. The Netherlands houses a regional warehouse for US-owned F-35 parts that distributes them to countries that request them, including Israel. Anna Holligan reports.
The appeals court judges wrote, Israel does not sufficiently take into account the consequences for the civilian population when conducting its attacks, and therefore found that there is a clear risk that serious violations of the humanitarian law of war will be committed in Gaza with Israel's F-35 fighter planes. A group of NGOs brought the case to block the export of the US-owned aircraft parts from a warehouse in the Netherlands. The Dutch trade minister is studying the verdict. The government could launch an appeal at the Netherlands Supreme Court. This judgment could have implications elsewhere, as other rights groups may see potential to exert influence on the conflict through similar legal channels.
Anna Holligan. The world of athletics is in mourning after the death of one of its brightest stars, the Kenyan world marathon record holder Kelvin Kiptum, who's been killed in a car accident. He was just 24. He set the world record in the Chicago Marathon last October with a winning time of 2 hours and 35 seconds. The man whose record he broke, Kenyan marathon runner Eliud Kipchoge, was among those to pay tribute to him, as was the sports minister Ababu Namwamba.
A very dark day for our country, a very dark day for the athletics fraternity, both in Kenya and across the world. Really, we are lost for words for this horrible, horrible loss of a brilliant, brilliant young man who was destined to dominate and rule the world of marathon running for a long, long time.
The former steeplechase world champion, Milka Chemos, said she was devastated.
We have all known Kiptum as our best and even he was in our team for the Olympics. So we are just in this world as we are nothing. I can just say pole, pole to everyone, pole to all the family.
Our Africa sports reporter in Nairobi, Celestine Keroni, told us what was known about the crash in which no other vehicles were involved.
Police have released the incident report from the crash, which happened on a Sunday night. They say Kelvin Kiptum was driving a car that had two other occupants, one of them his coach, Javier Hakizimana, who is a Rwandese national, and a young lady. Now, the police say that Kiptum lost control of the vehicle. It veered off the road, went into a ditch and hit a tree. And Kiptum and his coach died on site while the lady was taken to hospital with serious injuries.
Tell us about Kelvin Kiptum, because he came from very humble beginnings.
Yes, he did come from humble beginnings, and he was the breakout star, Kenya's breakout star in a very long time. Kenya has not had this kind of a breakout star, especially in marathon running, for quite a while, almost a decade. And so there was a lot of excitement around Kelvin Kiptum because he was an athlete who in 2022 ran his first marathon and won. And the next year in 2023 broke the marathon world record and was now talking about trying to run the marathon in under 2 hours. You know, something that has never been done before. Yet in 2018, Kelvin Kiptum borrowed a pair of running shoes so he could run his first official athletics event. He had come quite the journey, and so a lot that endeared him to a lot of Kenyans, his backstory, and then he was being seen as this Kenyan who could then challenge his compatriot, Eliud Kipchoge, who is considered the greatest marathon runner of all time by many Kenyans. And so these two were in Kenya's Olympics team, and Eliud had even talked about, oh, it would be great to, you know, to run with him, to run with this new upcoming star. So it's been quite shocking, really. You know, the word, if this country woke up to a shock that is almost palpable, I can tell you.
And he'd already achieved so much. He was just 24. He could have achieved so much more.
Yes, he could have. And, you know, a lot of Kenyans were seeing him as the athlete to take Kenya beyond. You know, Kenya is used to athletic stars. But there was something about Kelvin. And when you speak to a lot of athletic commentators, they say there was a fearlessness around him when he runs. So I think that is what endeared him as well to just anybody who loved athletics.
Celestine Keroni. It's a sad outcome for a beauty and skincare brand that in the 1980s and 90s won legions of young fans for its opposition to testing products on animals and its ethical trading ethos. The Body Shop, a common sight in many high streets and shopping malls around the world, is facing job losses and shop closures after it was announced it was appointing administrators. The Body Shop was founded by the environmental campaigner and entrepreneur Anita Roddick in 1976, before she sold it 30 years later. Here she is in 2006, shortly before her death, talking about her vision for the business.
The word brand wasn't floating around when I started in, you know, 30-odd years ago. All I wanted was an honourable enterprise. I never even wanted a business because, for me, a business was seen as a small version of a large corporation, and I didn't like hierarchy, and women entrepreneurs hate hierarchy. So, no, I never thought it would be, ever thought it would be as big as it was. But I knew in my DNA, whatever I was going to do was going to be iconoclastic and different, and I'd be, you know, putting two fingers up at the system, whatever the system was.
The brand and retail expert, Mary Portis, told us what made The Body Shop so ahead of its time.
She was the first to go out there with an ethically sourced, naturally based ingredient. What's so sad about this is we talk about that if this was invented today, people would have just been like jumping up and down, you know, because so many people have copied it. She was the head of the game. And the green beauty landscape has transformed now with sport for choice and there's been so much competition. But it was a mecca of joy. And I everything that she stood for was what business should be today. You know, she talked about business being a force for good and making progress and having effect in the world. And so when you bought from The Body Shop, you didn't just buy, which I loved, the white musk eau de toilette, which I sprayed every Saturday morning in there, or the shiny bath pearls. you bought into a value system that she stood for, and you wanted to be part of her gang. Yes, it was innovative. It was ahead of the game. It went global. We are talking every city, every town you turned up. In fact, I was in Australia over January, and there was a body shop in there, and it was packed and heaving. It didn't need to go bust. But I think here's the reason why. It got bought out by L'Oreal. L'Oreal knows how to use brands. It did not know how to run a retailer. And so the soul went out of it. You got a very organized business model, but you didn't get the business that was actually speaking to a value system of people anymore. So it sort of fell behind for a long while. And then sadly, you know, in comes the private equity people. And when you start looking at the bottom line and you don't look at actually the process, the vision and what made it successful and put that back at the heart, you're in a tricky, tricky path. And the sad thing is everybody's jumping on this bandwagon now. We have to look at the way that she did business. And we've lost one of the greatest brands we've ever seen in this country.
Mary Portis. Still to come on this podcast, how one member of the victorious Kansas City Chiefs team, who also happens to be Taylor Swift's boyfriend, is celebrating his Super Bowl win.
I'm pretty sure Vegas is going to roll out the red carpet. I'm going to be Elvis for a night.
Who were the Black 14?
14 football players who were at University of Wyoming in 1969.
14 student athletes who paid a heavy price for planning a show of support against racism.
It hit the campus like wildfire.
Some of them was getting death threats.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
It was a complete surprise that he kicked us off the team.
What are we going to do with our lives? How are we going to get our degrees?
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Ukraine's difficulties in getting more funding out of the US Congress are having an impact on the front line. When Russia launched its full-scale invasion, fighters in Ukraine rushed to those front lines, a whole nation was mobilized, and Western aid and weapons poured in. 2 years on, the headlines have switched to talk of blocked funding, an ammunition shortage, and problems recruiting soldiers. For Ukraine, the goal of liberating its territory hasn't changed, but as our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports from Cherkasy in central Ukraine, the price it's having to pay for that is rising all the time.
These are the patrols many Ukrainian men now dread. Pavlo Zhilin and his team are hunting for draft dodgers because Ukraine needs a lot more soldiers.
As we were just crossing the square a moment ago, a young man saw them coming and swerved a mile wide to avoid them.
In a nearby cafe, Pavlo tells me how his arm was blown off on the front line in a Russian mortar attack. When he recovered, Pavlo wanted to go on serving his country. So now he goes out looking for men who can still fight. It bothers him that they're not flooding to the front lines anymore as volunteers.
There's a full-scale war, but it's still like people don't care. We need everyone to come together, like they did on the first day.
But people's hesitancy is not really surprising. When I ask Pavlo about friends who've served with him, he tells me there's almost no one left from his company.
Everyone's either injured like me or dead.
When Lilia's son was fighting in Avdiivka, she couldn't rest until she got a daily text message that he was okay. One in the morning and one at night. The family's own town is still occupied by Russian forces, and Serhii signed up to fight to help liberate it. Then he was badly injured in a mortar attack. But Lilia shows me recent videos of him messing around in a wheelchair with his sister in the hospital grounds. She calls his recovery a miracle, but it also terrifies her, because Serhii says once he's fully fit, he wants to go back to the front. He says there's not enough soldiers there, and his friends need him. Lilia tells me she's praying for the war to end before Serhii recovers fully. All over Ukraine, the cemeteries are filling up with soldiers. I met Ina beside the grave of her son, Vladislav. He was 22, killed by a Russian landmine. When I ask Ina what she thinks about the Ukrainian men who don't want to fight, she looks at all the graves around us and she tells me she can't judge them.
Do you think my son wasn't afraid? I was afraid too when he went. Everyone is afraid of dying, but maybe being enslaved by Russia is scarier.
Artem, July 2023. Alexander, February 2023. Vasil, August 2023. Just walking down this gravel alleyway with graves of soldiers on either side. So when you come to places like this and you see people crying quietly at the gravesides, that it really brings home the huge cost that Ukraine is paying in this war. And nobody knows when it's going to end.
That report by Sarah Rainsford. Now to Brazil, where a senior military officer has been arrested for his alleged role in a plan to overthrow the government. Colonel Bernardo Correa Neto was previously an aide of the former president Jair Bolsonaro. Leonardo Rocha is our America's regional editor.
He's been accused of organizing a meeting with some army special forces in November 22. That was 4 weeks after President Jair Bolsonaro lost the presidential election to his left-wing rival, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. So this colonel is accused of holding a meeting with his special forces, allegedly to plan a coup. So they would take part, it would be an important part of a military coup that would keep Mr. Bolsonaro in power and prevent Mr. Lula da Silva from taking office about a month later.
Now, he's one of several members of the military who've been arrested in recent days. What's been the reaction to these arrests from Mr. Bolsonaro himself?
Well, when the operation was launched, that was on Thursday, that was a big, big thing in Brazil. And one of the main things, many people are expecting Mr. Bolsonaro to be arrested. There was a lot of doubts about that. And eventually, the former president was forced to surrender his passport so that he doesn't leave the country. Three other people were arrested, all military officers, accused of taking part in this big plot that was allegedly organized by Mr. Bolsonaro. The former president has been speaking to many outlets in Brazil, and he says it's all wrong. He might have discussed options during meetings, but he never plotted against democracy. What he says is that the left controls the government, that the Supreme Court is hostile to the right, hostile to him, and that they did all they could to favor the left-wing candidate in the election. And he said something needs to be done, but he never meant to stage a military coup. We have to remember here that Mr. Bolsonaro is a former army captain who praised the military government that was in charge in Brazil for 21 years.
And Mr. Bolsonaro still has a lot of supporters amongst Brazilians. What do they say? Do they say it's a bit of a witch hunt?
They say that. It's all political. They expect nothing different. They say the Supreme Court judges are all siding with the left-wing government. And he is still popular, has about 30% at least of support. And even if he can't run, his support is very important and it will be decisive in the next elections. We have local elections this year, big cities like Rio, São Paulo, where the political future of possible presidential candidates is going to be decided.
Leonardo Rocha speaking to Nick Miles. The risk of extinction is rising for some of the world's migratory species, such as green turtles or African penguins, according to a landmark UN report. It's the first time a global assessment has been carried out of the great explorers of the animal kingdom. Kelly Molsh is the lead author of the study.
These species are wide-ranging from birds to sea turtles to whales to gorillas, but really it's about understanding the key threats to these species. And we found that it's overexploitation and habitat loss. This really shows the importance of taking action and really about scaling up our actions to address the underlying threats and to protect, connect and restore the important sites they rely on.
Our climate and science reporter Esme Stellard told me more about the report.
This is the first report that's looked across the world at these particular species. What it found was that nearly half of the species assessed are facing decline. And actually that varies depending on what animal groups you looked at. So they said for fish species, it's almost all of them are under or at risk of extinction. And the overwhelming reason for that is the decline is being driven by human activity. So predominantly it's the excessive hunting and killing of animals, whether that's for trade or for sport and leisure, but also things like the expansion of our towns and cities, which bring with it noise and light pollution, which has particularly big impacts on migratory species who rely heavily on their senses as they traverse across different countries.
And what would the consequences be of not taking action?
Well, I spoke to Amy Frankel, who is the UN Executive Secretary to the Convention for the Protection of Migratory Species. And she said to me that if we don't succeed in turning this around, so having a significant difference on preventing this exploitation, we will see extinction. She said there are some species in this report that are very much already on the edge of extinction.
What does this report suggest needs to be done to tackle the problem? Because it's quite a difficult one to tackle, given that these species often travel long distances across the globe.
Exactly. So there are some countries that are making significant progress in protecting animals that live just within their borders. But obviously, there's no point doing that if then an animal was to traverse into another country and the regulations aren't the same. So the key message here is that it needs to be a consistent approach across all countries. The report suggests some recommendations, including establishing where the migration pathways are for the most at-risk animals and kind of creating biodiversity corridors for them. They also recommend that countries really look at minimizing physical barriers to the migration of animals, such as dams. And in fact, countries are meeting today in Uzbekistan to discuss how they might begin implementing some of these actions.
Esme Stallard. It's that time of year when people across China spend time with their relatives celebrating the Lunar New Year. And this year, increasing numbers are pouring themselves a glass of whiskey. Our business reporter Katie Silver has the story.
For millennia in China, booze has been about baijiu, a very strong clear liquid made with fermented grains, often sorghum. But in recent times, we've seen the growing popularity of alcohol from abroad. China is now the world's greatest importer of red wine. And when it comes to the hard stuff, whiskey is where the growth is at. Just over a year ago, China's whiskey market was valued at $2.3 billion. That's expected to almost triple by 2027, an annual growth rate of 20% each year from the Chinese market, compared to 4% growth worldwide. It's something whiskey sellers here in Asia are looking to capitalise on. I went along to the Maison de Whiskey in central Singapore to find out. Jamie Lee heads up the French company's business in Japan, China and Korea.
Why has the price of whiskey exploded so much?
The thing about whiskey is the age is really important. You have to wait at least 10 to 20 years to have the result. You have to have this instinct to do this collection before everybody do it. The Chinese New Year is kind of like a Christmas in Europe. It's like a festive and people want to spend money, buy a nice gift and have something memorable. So whiskey is part of their memory as well.
International brands are taking the Made in China route to cater to this growing demand. The French alcohol company Pernod Ricard, behind such brands as Jameson, Beefeater Gin and Absolut Vodka, is ploughing $140 million into a production base in the Sichuan area. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site with mineral water and year-round precipitation. Perfect conditions, apparently, for whiskey making. It's a similar story for rival Diageo, which opened a plant in December. Diageo and Pernod Ricard are battling to be the world's top spirit maker, and the potential for an emerging market like China makes it a key battleground in that fight. Diageo says demand is so strong, there's space for everyone. It helps that many young people in China are shunning baijiu in favour of less alcoholic international options, as Alison Malmsten from Daishu Consulting explains.
Baijiu doesn't necessarily satisfy some of the modern demands of Chinese liquor consumption, which include bar hopping and mixology.
She says China's whiskey consumers are young, highly educated, increasingly female, and with money to spend. It means international whiskey makers are in high spirits as they look to take a big gulp of the market.
Katie Silver. The Super Bowl, the climax of the American football season and one of the world's most watched sporting events, has been won for the second year running by the Kansas City Chiefs. They beat the San Francisco 49ers by 25 points to 22 in a thrilling close-run contest. Nesta McGregor was at the stadium in Las Vegas.
Super Bowl 58 is underway.
America's showpiece sporting event lived up to the hype. The San Francisco 49ers were twice on the brink of victory, but a last-gasp goal by the Chiefs sent the game into overtime, and then a touchdown in the dying seconds, set up by their quarterback Patrick Mahomes, helped secure them victory and back-to-back titles.
In the shotgun, Mahomes, four-man front, receiver in motion, low snap, he runs and he throws, caught, touchdown, it's caught! Hardman caught the ball! The Chiefs have won! The Chiefs have won! Got me
feeling it. The R&B singer Usher provided the halftime entertainment, but he wasn't the only celebrity drawing the attention of the cameras. Taylor Swift was in the stands cheering on her boyfriend, Travis Kelce, the Chiefs player she's been dating since September.
After the match, Nesta McGregor caught up with Travis Kelce.
Congratulations, man. Does this one feel any different?
It does, man. It feels 10 times better, man. Adversity, what this team went through, the naysayers, but on top of that, man, just how much fun we have coming in the building. You can see how we're enjoying this one right now, how much fun we have with each other.
How will you and your lovely pop star girlfriend be celebrating?
I'm pretty sure Vegas is going to roll out the red carpet. I'm going to be Elvis for a night.
Travis Kelce there celebrating a much-deserved win. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Dan Elric. The producer was David Lewis. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Where can a vehicle from Mazda's electrified lineup take you? From powering up to winding down. Electrify every moment with the 2024 Mazda CX-90 plug-in hybrid. Learn more at Mazda.ca.